We're going through the book of Jude and reviewing some of the lessons. Something's not going on well with the microphone. Is that on? Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Is that better? Not better? So we have a connection problem or a impedance mismatch or something. Is that on? Is that going on? It was going in and out during the sermonette a couple times. But so is that better? That's solved? Okay. All right. That sounds good. Got to make sure everybody can hear. We left off last time talking about dreamers. And we showed that what Jude was referring to had also been addressed back in Deuteronomy 13, where people were dreamers were also considered to be astrologers, those who had fake dreams or false messages from God. Sometimes some of those dreams and predictions actually come true. They're sort of like, you know, magicians or prophets. But it says if they would teach you to disobey God or do something you know that was wrong, then you were to reject them and reject any authority they say they might have. So here we are now in verse 8 in Jude. We talked about also these dreamers, those who had these supposed signs from God or supposed miracles that they would perform. It says these dreamers defile the flesh. They use these dreams to tell people some false doctrine or advise them to do something wrong that would actually defile their flesh. Now the question we have to ask is, what does it mean to defile the flesh? Is he talking about taking a knife and hurting ourselves, or perhaps it's some other thing he's mentioning? Let's go back to a couple of scriptural references on this. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 17 is one place that describes defiling the flesh and what it actually means. Well, we'll see there, this is a defiling not of our physical body per se, but of the fact that the body of a Christian is also the temple of God's Holy Spirit. That is, the Spirit dwells now in the hearts and minds of men, not in physical buildings. This is, you know, a follow-through to what happened on the day of Pentecost, where when the Spirit of God came, it did not come to the building that Herod the Great had rebuilt as the temple, but instead it came in a very, you know, small but discernible form and sat on the foreheads or on the heads of each one of the disciples there in Solomon's porch, in the porch on the side of the temple. And that little flickering of a piece of the Shekinah glory, or the evidence of the presence of God, and demonstrate he was now dwelling in people, not in buildings made with hands. So in 1 Corinthians 7, the subject here obviously is we are the temple of God. And in chapter 3, and so that started in verse 14, if anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he'll receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. So there can be a fiery trial that will reveal what's true and good and honest and pure about us. It can also reveal the dross that needs to be removed. Notice, if anyone defiles the temple of God. And so when these people were writing and saying things that Jude had to address, they were defiling the flesh or saying things that would cause people to sin and therefore defiling the temple of God that they were. It says God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. So the temple is us. The temple is this physical existence that God has given to us temporarily, and that is where the Spirit of God is supposed to dwell. And these dreamers were pronouncing these either magic signs or some sort of prediction ahead of time, and now they were saying, well, they are, you know, they were going to be the authority to be looked to, and therefore people should do what they say, which, of course, was to defile themselves. Let's go back over to 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1, where Paul also addresses something very similar to the minister Timothy. He mentions here in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10, I'm sorry, let's drop back a little bit farther here in the chapter. Verse 8, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully. So people can talk about the law of God and use it unlawfully, which is what the people in Jude were doing. They were saying they could break the law, and because of this marvelous grace that God was bestowing upon us, all sin could be forgiven. Therefore, the more you sin, the more God gives you grace, the more glory gives to him, so therefore nothing wrong with sin. They were using it as a license to sin. and therefore defiling the flesh or defiling the body of God's Spirit. Knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous person. The only righteous person was Jesus Christ. The rest of us are all obviously unrighteous and in need very much of some guidance in our lives. He says, for the lawless and subordinate, the ungodly and for sinners, the unholy and profane. And of course, we all have to understand, we come to conversion, that you know, the heart of mankind is at enmity with God's law and desperately wicked at its very core. So we have to change the way we are. And of course, with God's Spirit and God's help, we do that. He says, for the profane, for murderers of fathers, murderers of mothers, for manslayers, fornicators, sodomites, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and if there's any other thing that's contrary to sound doctrine. So he lists all of these sins, Paul does to Timothy, that people might say are okay because they misuse the teaching about the law of God. And then in verse 11, according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which was committed to my trust. And so he says, look, the gospel is the truth about being able to be forgiven, but not to be perverted, so that people then change that into a license for sin. Now, the next thing that's mentioned in Jude, in verse 8, is these people that reject authority and then speak evil of dignities or dignitaries. Now, the word for dignitaries or dignities here is the Greek word doxa, D-O-X-H-A is how we would spell it in English. And when you have these words that they tell you in Greek R, or Hebrew R, it's just they listen to the word and they kind of phonetically spell it in English. It's not really spelled in English. It's just spelled in Greek or Hebrew, but we try to render it in a way that we can pronounce it and somehow understand it in our language. So the word doxa means honorable or praiseworthy. It is applicable to spirit beings such as the angels or the archangels, but also it could be applicable to ministers that God has called, to apostles and to others. When you look at this verse in commentaries, there's been a great deal written about this phrase, speaking evil of dignitaries. And in most cases, of course, it does. They do talk about the fact that they were angels, because that's illustrated here in the next verse. But it also means far more than that. It really means applicable to those to whom God has given honor or made praiseworthy. Now, let's look at some examples. How does Satan reject authority and speak evil of dignities? First, let's go back to the very beginning, Genesis chapter 3. Because Satan still works the same way today as he did back then. He still gets people to bend and twist their thoughts, just like he did to Mother Eve. All he has is a new generation to work with every 30 or 40 years. But the rules still apply. The things that he says and the way he tries to get people to disobey God and to go back on their word, various things, still are the same. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 4, the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die. So what he's saying here is, don't trust what God has said. You can't really believe what he said. He's sowing distrust, sowing suspicion. Can you really trust this guy? Can you really trust what he said? He won't really mean that. For God knows in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. So he's sowing suspicion. He's sowing a matter of distrust. And that is the way people still work when they're doing this today. They sow distrust. They begin to say, well, we can't really trust that person who has this job or this authority or this whatever commission from God, because how do we know that his motives are pure? How do we know he's not doing it for some other reason, you know, the prestige or the money or whatever it might be? Paul was accused, of course, of both of those. So when the serpent said to the woman, didn't say, you know, you need to disobey God. The serpent said to the woman, you can't trust God. You need to be suspicious. You need to listen to this gossip, and you can't really be sure he's saying what he's saying is right. So that tactic is still with us today. It's how people begin the speaking evil of dignitaries or those to whom God has given honor. Let's also go over to Numbers chapter 16 and verse 3. Numbers chapter 16, most of you are already familiar with, concerns the rebellion of Korah. Now, Korah was a Levite. And he thought, well, all of us should have the same authority as Moses and Aaron. Who do these Moses and Aaron guys think they are? You know, it hasn't changed much people today still look on those who have authority or those who have been chosen for something, and they say, well, we can all be that way. We don't need to be giving any particular honor to this person or that person. This you might say, is the beginning of congregationalism in the Scriptures, where people believe that everybody in the congregation has equal authority and equal responsibility and equal calling from God, which is not necessarily the case. Obviously, God has a ministry, and it talks about differentiation of the abilities and gifts we're given, but also the responsibility levels in the New Testament and other places. But in this case, Korah decided, basically, he wanted to be in charge, but he would get there by convincing 250 of his good buddies and leaders in the congregation that they should also join him. So when people speak evil of dignities in this illustration, you know, they go around and do a lot of talking behind the scenes and get other people on their side. And they kind of get a following or their own little, you know, rebellion group going. In chapter 16 and verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, so he was a Kohathite Levite, is one of those who was supposed to carry the implements of the tabernacle, very important responsibility among the three branches of Levi. With Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben. He took men, they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation. Now, it must have taken some time to organize these guys to get together to do this. It must have taken quite a lot of, you know, gossip and talk about, you know, undermining Moses and suspicion, we can't trust him. A lot must have been said. And representatives of the congregation, men of renown, these are men who should have known better, that joined here with Korah. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourself. Now, that in itself is completely wrong, because Moses didn't take anything on himself. In fact, he ran from the responsibility. And Aaron certainly never volunteered for the responsibility of being high priest. He was just told to do it, and that was it. So Moses and Aaron really had not taken anything upon themselves. They were required by God to do these jobs that they were given. So their basic premise of this crowd of Korah and his followers is simply wrong. It cannot be substantiated. In fact, the opposite can be. So he says, you take too much upon yourselves. Their basic premise was wrong. And they said, for all the congregation is holy. Now, they just worshiped the golden calf and done a whole bunch of other things that prove they weren't holy. But this is the line of reasoning, is we are all in this together. We all have the same calling. We all have the same, you know, holiness, whatever the words they would use. It says, every one of them. So this is the beginning of congregationalism, or you might say mob rule, if you wanted to use that word for it in the Old Testament. And the Lord is among them. Well, that's true, the Lord was dwelling among them, but think about how many times in this entire scenario in the wilderness, you know, that God was, for instance, on the outside, and only Moses could go out to God's tabernacle. It was only on that one Day of Atonement where God finally agreed to come back and have the tabernacle in the midst of the camp, because the people had defiled themselves, and he had separated himself from them. So all of these statements of Korah are essentially wrong. You know, when you start with a false premise, you just keep adding on one mistake after another, and the more you try to justify that false premise, it just turns into a vortex that eventually, of course, ends in a train wreck. Now, we're going through that, of course, in our country. You've been watching the news here recently. The $700 billion bailout that was supposed to solve all the problems went the same way as the $150 billion bailout 3 months before. I only heard in the news yesterday they can't find more than about $200 billion of the $700. It all disappeared into thin air. I didn't get any of it. Anybody else find any of it in their bank account or in their... But somehow $500 billion disappeared, and now, of course, the answer to that is, since we've got that disappeared, we have to manufacture more, and they're talking now in terms of trillions. It's really sad. If you think about some of the news that we've had, the worst layoffs and the largest amount of economic decline, so to speak, since the end of World War II, what did they do back at the end of World War II? Well, we had this... The only wise Democrat I can think of was Harry Truman. And this guy had more sense about money than any other president or any other group of leaders I've ever known. So when World War II was over, 9 million servicemen were unemployed, and all these massive factories that were building tanks and airplanes shut down, and all these, you know, unemployment almost reached 20%. It was huge. Harry Truman said, no, we're not going to start government programs. We're not going to build highways and bridges and roads. We're not going to start soup lines. We're just going to let the marketplace take care of things. And, oh, he had all sorts of people attacking him. In fact, his popularity level went down to the lowest in history of any president because he would not come in with buckets of government money. I mean, he was so cheap that he outlawed butter in the White House. They had to buy margarine. And he was to go in the kitchen and go through all the ingredients that the cooks were using and tell them to buy cheaper stuff. So, and he did that with every government program. So what happened? Well, a year and a half later, they were making cars instead of tanks. Remember all the Chevrolets and Oldsmobiles and Buicks and Packards that came out of the early 50s? It wouldn't happen with the government programs. And they started making appliances, all sorts of refrigerators, and everybody before that just had ice boxes. Most kids in this room can't remember what an ice box was. But I can. My grandmother had one. I can remember ice wagons coming around, you know, ice trucks coming around and selling you a big block of ice. And you put it in your ice box, it would last about 5 to 6 days. In the summer and the winter, it might last a little bit longer than that. But all of a sudden, we had refrigerators you plugged in and stoves and houses started being built. And within a year and a half, they didn't need any more government programs because the economy was buzzing along and everybody was getting jobs and lumber mills were starting up. And the lesson there was very simple. You know, savings and thrift and just toughing it out until the system worked very well. What we have today is kind of the same thing as Corey here. He's starting from a bad premise, making all sorts of conclusions on that premise that are even worse, and then, of course, the earth opened up and swallowed up Korah and all of his followers. And since our country seems to be completely bent on multiplying their problems over and over, certainly the economic projections for the next few years, well, there's simply no way, really no way it can be fundamentally better. There might be some temporary bubbles, but essentially we are in some pretty serious shape, pretty serious trouble. Just one observation, and this is just an observation, nothing else, is that I think it was in Deuteronomy, was it 17, I forget exactly, God told Moses, you shall not set a non-Israelite over you. And so when we have the inauguration next week, we're going to have the first non-Israelite ruling over an Israelite nation. Boy, perhaps in our lifetime, I can't think of any other occasion. Certainly all the Ephraimites in Britain would be Ephraimitic and the of King David's descendants. So we are violating God's law, not knowing that we are Israel, and we are going to, I think, pay a severe penalty for that. We can almost make the case we already are paying penalties for that. But we'll see. Church is not a place for political commentary. No matter what system of men it is, it's going to fail. And there's no men or no system of men that can prevent the things that are going to be happening in prophecy. Our faith is not in any particular system of politics or political party or belief system. Our faith is in God's kingdom. But it's just interesting to observe from an historical perspective that no one learns any lessons from history. They just keep repeating them. And when we see a good example in history, we don't follow it. When we see a very bad one, we seem to want to follow that very quickly. And not much different than Korah, because Korah's rebellion has been repeated over and over and over down through history, and the result has been the same. Well, let's go over now to Psalm chapter 12 and verse 34. Psalm chapter 12 and verse 34. I'm sorry, 3 through 4. There's only 8 verses, so it can't be 34. Here, David is simply explaining, you know, what happened when people talked against him. Now, David obviously made some real serious mistakes. He did his thing with Bathsheba. He had too many wives to begin with, and he should have just been happy with the 4 or 5 he had, but instead he continued on with this thing with Bathsheba. And I think he'd have been really happy if he just would have kept Abigail. She was a great girl of great character. And he said, well, this is the girl for me. I'm just going to stay with her and you know, have God's descendants of the throne through her. I think God would have blessed that greatly. But he didn't. He also numbered Israel. He did some other things that I think would be questionable. But despite all of that, he did have people who tried to slander him, notably his own son, Absalom. Notice what he says here. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips and the tongue that speaks proud things. So these who are despising dignitaries, speaking against those that God has given dignity to, he's saying, well, look, what they're doing is they're flattering the people they're talking to. They flatter their audience and say, well, we all have the same authority. We've all been chosen by God. Why can't we all, whatever, congregationalism, so to speak. and the tongue that speaks proud things. So he speaks these proud things just like Korah did. So David understood that was going on also in his time. We have to understand that it still goes on in our time, and to beware that we are not taken in by it. He said, who have said with our tongue, we will prevail. In other words, we will get rid of this guy. And certainly in the case of Absalom, that was tried. And David was at least gotten out of the way for a short time. Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? So nobody's Lord over us. We are simply going to take the lordship for ourselves. So this account here of David is interesting. That, you know, some of David's Psalms, you go through them, and you can get little snippets of what was going on in his life and the personal experiences he went through. And you have to kind of, you know, fill in the little blank details that aren't there. But certainly it's educational to do that and see he also had the same experience. Now the summary of the problem is over in Luke chapter 19 and verse 14. Luke chapter 19 and verse 14. Here we have the parable of a nobleman going to a far country, then to receive for himself a kingdom. Receive for himself this territory to rule, this group of people to rule over, these laws. So a certain nobleman went to a far country, verse 12, to receive for himself a kingdom. We know that represents Jesus Christ ascending to heaven and receiving a kingdom. He said he would go to prepare a place for us and come back so that we can be with him. He called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and said, do business till I come. So he gave us all, or gave them all, a portion of his spirit or a certain amount of ability to accomplish things while he was gone. But notice, his citizens hated him, saying, even sent a delegation after him, saying, we will not have this man reign over us. Now they still wanted the kingdom. They still wanted the territory. But they said, we are not going to do it his way. We are going to do it our way. And then we'll get rid of his laws, his guidance, his rulership, and we will simply replace it with our own. And this certainly has to be the summary of false religion over the years, and especially mainstream Christianity that uses Christ's name, but they will not have him reign over them. They devise their own laws, their own doctrines, their own concepts, because they simply have rejected what he is saying. So it was that when he returned, of course, he commanded to know how each man had done by trading. Over in verse 27, the summary is, bring here those enemies of mine whom did not want me to reign over them and slay them before me. The number one qualification of a Christian is we must want Jesus Christ to reign over us. We must invite him to do that. We cannot simply say, oh no, I'm going to reject his way and do it my way. We really do have to have the testimony of Jesus Christ and want him to reign over us. So speaking evil of dignitaries and despising those that are in authority is something that's not new in our time. It is something that obviously was going on during the time of Jude, and he warned us through his letter that these people would do that by speaking evil of dignitaries, and of course, most often that's done by sowing distrust. Oh, we say we can't believe that person's motives, and sowing distrust about them. Now the next subject that's mentioned here is Michael the archangel and disputing about with the devil about the body of Moses. Now this is an interesting verse. It's been written about a great deal. You look at commentaries, you might even see pages in some commentaries about it. But what it simply says is that Michael the archangel, so Michael is an archangel. We'll read a couple other verses here that he's... In one place he's called one of the chief princes. So there were other archangels apparently. Mr. Armstrong used to theorize that perhaps there had been three, that Gabriel was one, Michael was one, and Lucifer had been one at some point before he was rebellious and cast down. It says, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, did not bring against him railing accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Now, where did this come from? Where did this story come from? About this disputing about the body of Moses and Michael and Lucifer, the devil, doing this sort of tug-of-war. Here's dead Moses. All the Bible tells us is that Moses died and God buried him on Mount Nebo. But where does this come from, this story? And it's quoted here in the Bible, so it must have happened in some form. But where did Jude get the information? Well, it's kind of an interesting study, where it might have come from. The first references that are given are that it comes from a manuscript called the Assumption of Moses. Now, the Assumption of Moses was a fragment of a scroll. It looks a lot like a Dead Sea Scroll. I've seen a picture of them on the internet website. That much of it is missing. So what you've got is this 6th century, the 500s A.D., where they have this scroll in pieces in Greek, and it's called the Assumption of Moses. Now, it was first made public or written or translated by Gelasius of Cyzicus. It's actually called the Cerani, C-E-R-I-A-N-I manuscript. And in the Cerani manuscript about called the Ascension or the Assumption of Moses, there's nothing in here about Moses' death or about Michael and anybody else playing tug-of-war over the body. This manuscript basically is about Moses talking to Joshua before he dies, and also a brief outline of Jewish history. There are some prophecies in there about the persecution of the Jews. Basically, it's probably a fictitious book that was written as history afterwards, and somebody in the Middle Ages just wrote the thing up. Who knows? It may have come out of Egypt. We really don't know. All we know for sure is that the Assumption of Moses, where most people say this comes from, does not have the story of Moses' death and what happened with his body. Now, where it does come from is that after this manuscript became public, some of the scribes back in the Catholic Church, what do they call them? I guess cloisters or scholarly schools, whatever, decided they wanted to fill in what was missing. So they went to other sources that could have been quoting from or known something about this Assumption of Moses, and they then began to fill in the chapters and verses and parts of that scroll that were missing. So they came up with what is called the Testament of Moses. And there is an English version published in 1897, and it has some of this in here. Now what they did is they went back and looked at this scripture in Jude, and they said, well, it must have been in the Assumption of Moses, so they added that in there. But they also looked at two additional original Greek writings. One was a historian called Athanasius, A-T-H-A-N-A-S-I-U-S, who wrote a commentary on Scripture. And the other, of course, was Origen. Now, Origen, very influential man in church history, had a large school of not only scriptural study, but scriptural translation in Egypt and Alexandria. For a long time in the 200s A.D., late 200s A.D., Origen came up with things like the Trinity. He was very influential in formation of that doctrine and some others that eventually became codified and adopted by the Catholic Church under Constantine in the Council of Nicaea in 323 A.D. Origen is an odd guy. In first place, he castrated himself, which I think would kind of rule him out for being sane in my book, or most people's book. But because he thought he was being tempted, you know, he had all these impure thoughts, so he thought that was the way to solve them. However, he did have at least 200 scholars who spent a great deal of time copying manuscripts. He copied the Septuagint, copied all sorts of copies of the Bible. But Origen didn't have what you might call much of a closed system. The scribes who sort of add their own ideas, they could change things as they wanted to. He was the one, or his school was the one, that very likely wrote the Sinaitic text that was found on Mount Sinai and also the Alexandrian texts, which differ from the received texts in Byzantium in significant ways. Certainly they differ from the Masoretic texts of the Old Testament. And one example of that is the Moffat translation of the Old Testament, where Moffat uses the Sinaitic texts as his chronology. So places in Isaiah, you've got like part of chapter 8 inserted in part of chapter 20, and then it's got chapter 50. And reading through Isaiah in the Moffat translation is not productive because it is so chopped up. Well, Moffat uses the Sinaitic text, which came from Origen, as he assumed that must be right because the paper on which it's written is older than what we found in Byzantium, which, of course, is a false assumption to make. This is not a lecture, by the way, on the New Testament, what we call the codices, or the scrolls that 5,000 and 300 and some different codices in the New Testament. But just to let you know, Origen probably also had one of his scholars who wrote up an additional commentary on the Assumption of Moses, or wrote some sort of history. A lot of what came out of there, of course, was lost because of the burning of the Alexandrian libraries. But the fragments that we have from Origen, I would just say that the assumption is that the conclusion is that is an interesting from an historical perspective, but from a theologically accurate perspective, I would not trust him or those who worked for him or the pieces of literature that came out of his monastery and his school there in northern Egypt in Alexandria. So this story about Michael the archangel contending with the devil is obviously true because it's in the scriptures, but where it actually came from, we really don't know. The theory that it came from the assumption of Moses' story written who knows when is just simply conjecture. There is no actual proof of that. Now, there are two schools of thought about this verse. The first one is the one we've already talked about, that when Moses died, that Satan the devil wanted to take the body of Moses, put it on some kind of a mountaintop, make it a shrine, and use it as a religious icon or shrine to divert the people of God away from worshiping God and instead worshiping Moses. Now, you could almost make a case that some did that not knowing where Moses' body was buried. They certainly have made a religion out of worshiping Abraham in one form or another. However, some of the other commentaries bring out that another understanding of the Greek is that the body of Moses could also include the body of his work or his life's work, that it could be that all during the 40 years of being in the wilderness, Satan was there trying to destroy the work that Moses was doing, that God was doing through Moses. So Michael the archangel was there contending with the devil about the work of Moses' life, those 40 years when he had them in the wilderness and was trying to teach them to do God's way, and many of them, of course, didn't do that. Many rebelled, but some did. Some listened to him, like Joshua and Caleb. So during that time, Michael the angel never even brought an accusation against Satan the devil, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." So either one of those is allowable in the original way it's written, and we'll have to wait and see, I suppose, what the actual truth of the matter was. In this commentary here, he mentions, "Let it be observed that the word archangel is never found in the plural in the scripture writings," although it does say that Michael is one of the chief princes. Says, "Nor is the word devil applied to the plurals." There are plurals, but it's the fallen spirits. Michael is this archangel, the head of the angelic orders, or the great dragon. Satan is the head of the diabolical orders, and of course those two are once again in contention in Revelation chapter 12, where it says Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels. Now, disputing about the body of Moses, this commentary says, "What this means I cannot tell, or from what source St. Jude drew it, unless from some tradition among his countrymen." He lists several Jewish sages that were written down, or at least their thoughts were passed down during that time, and they thought perhaps it was from a rabbi named Yalkut Rabuni, or Rubeni, maybe that was it. Who knows? The contention by Jude is not about the sacrifice of Isaac or the soul of Moses, but about the body of Moses. But why or wherefore we know not. Some think the devil wished to show the Israelites where Moses was buried, knowing they would then adore his body, and that Michael was then sent to resist this discovery. But it also could be the body of his work. In Daniel 10:13, 10:21, and 12:1, Michael is spoken of as one of the chief angels who took care of the Israelites as a nation. He may therefore have been the Lord who stood before Joshua the high priest in Zechariah 3 and verse 1, to have stood Satan being at the right hand to resist him. He says, the body of his work could apply to the thing itself. So the body of sin signifies sin itself, so the body of Moses could signify Moses himself or his life work and the truths he was trying to teach, the way of life he was trying to teach to the Israelites. So just those possibilities in the commentaries, that as it says, Michael the archangel here contended with the devil, that may have been going on the entire 40 years about the work of Moses and the teachings of Moses, or it may also have applied to the time when he died, and then somehow, even though God buried Moses, somehow then the devil tried to find the body, dig it up, and whatever, make some kind of a shrine out of it. So that's an interesting verse, and one that we'll probably never know the exact truth of, because there is no Old Testament reference that we can just turn to and say this is exactly what it's talking about. In verse 10, he continues. Well, actually, let's look at a couple other scriptures first. So let's go back to Daniel chapter 10 and verse 13. Daniel chapter 10 and verse 13. Michael has a future role to play. As we think about the angel Michael, the archangel, in the book of Daniel chapter 10, Daniel's been praying a great prayer in Daniel 9, And when God wanted to reveal to him this powerful prophecy about Persia and Greece and the king of the north and the king of the south and Antiochus Epiphanes and finally the 70 weeks prophecy, a very, very powerful prophecy that was given to him. But the angel that was trying to come and give this answer, this vision to Daniel, was withstood by the prince of Persia, which in this case, of course, would probably be Satan the devil. Because the prince of Persia did not want this beautiful prophecy and this very detailed reference that tells us very clearly how God's word is authoritative, how it's the very word of God. None of this could have been authored and written ahead of time without God's spirit and God's intervention. So obviously there's a reason why Satan the devil did not want this to be in the scriptures. In Daniel chapter 10 and verse 13, the angel says, "The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes." So he's an archangel, we know that. He's one of the chief princes, so let's assume that chief prince also means archangel, so he'd be one of the archangels, "came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia." So here Michael was able to help him defeat the kings of Persia and get through whatever barrier or fence had been erected by them. "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." And then down in verse 21, "I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." So no one's going to help him return and get back through this barrier of the prince of Persia except the archangel Michael. And let's also go over to 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10. Of course, 2 Peter is kind of a parallel, especially chapter 2, to the book here of Jude. We have another example here, and Peter just uses generalities about it. He doesn't use any specific example about people who were making accusations against dignitaries, whereas angels were afraid to make the same accusations against dignitaries. So 2 Peter chapter 2, let's begin in verse 9. "For the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation." So God knows how to deliver each one of us out of any temptation or challenge that we face. "And to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment." So those who were, all these examples he talked about, Sodom, Gomorrah, many others in that category, he's talking about those who are reserved for a day of judgment. "And especially those who walk according to the flesh in lust of uncleanness." So they commit these physical sins thinking that, well, God's forgiveness and his grace makes it all okay. "And despise authority." So the same people that Jude was writing about, Peter encountered, so they despise authority. "They're presumptuous, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries." Again, the Greek word doxa, those who are honorable or praiseworthy from God. So they are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries in this life, but he said, look at the angels who are greater in power and might than we are. There's no human being that comes anywhere close to the power of an angel. He said, those people, those angels who are greater in power and might, do not bring a railing accusation against them before the Lord. So the angels here don't bring accusations against people or against other angels. So the angels understand that all judgment is given into the hand of Jesus Christ. The only angel we have that does make accusation is Satan the devil, who accuses God's people before God day and night, it says in Revelation. Now let's go over to verse 10 of Jude. Very simple verse here about these men speak evil of whatever they don't know. So they think they know about a certain subject, and they talk about it, but they really don't know what they're talking about. Notice, whatever they know naturally, or in other words, from empirical knowledge. This is kind of the basis of what he's talking about here. I believe what Jude is referring to here is the same thing that Paul does several times, and that is the concept of the ancient Greek philosophers. Now, the ancient Greek philosophers didn't know God, but they were great thinkers. Some of the greatest minds and writers and authors in history have been those who were part of the Greek Enlightenment or philosophical time, the foundation of Western civilization. Men like Aristotle and Socrates, Aristophanes, and Homer, who wrote the Iliad, and some of the others, just to Mephistopheles, some of the great writers, Pericles, who was the real founder of democracy and the entire concept of democracy that was later copied And you know, our founding fathers were, for the most part, fairly conversant scholars about ancient classical history. If you haven't read some of those things in recent times, it's interesting to know that what they did is follow this same pattern. They looked at life as what can we see, touch, hear, and smell and experience. Today we call that empirical knowledge. They looked at the planets, looked at the stars, looked at the wind, looked at the human body and all the things we can do with exercise and of course, games and competition. And they began then to make conclusions about the spirit world, all of which, of course, were in error. They began to make conclusions about the purpose in man. All of those were in error. They began to make conclusions based on all this empirical evidence that they could see and touch and feel and experience, all of those things that they knew naturally, and they became completely in error. If you haven't read Socrates' trial, the trial of Socrates in recent times, you might best that back off from your old classical literature shelf. And Socrates does a pretty good job of telling them, you've gone through all these experiences for 200 years, and what have you come up with? Nothing. The modern-day stepchild of that probably is Nietzsche in the late 1880s, Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher. And of course, he is famous for saying, God is dead, we killed him. What he's really saying is we no longer have a God in our society to direct anything. Mankind is simply left to his own, to search around on his own, whatever he can find from empirical knowledge, and come to his own conclusions. Now, Nietzsche killed himself. He got so crazy with it, he said there's no purpose for life, and he killed himself. But he was simply the natural result of ancient Greek philosophy, because without a God to guide us, without a creator to give us a message as to why he created us, and what our ultimate purpose is, and what purpose the physical creation serves, and what laws should guide our life and how we should live, without God telling us that, mankind's life is fruitless. It's meaningless. It has no purpose. It is simply a matter of wasting time. So what Paul says here, or actually when Jude says, these things they know naturally, they are like brute beasts, and in these things they corrupt themselves. Without God guiding their life, or our lives in fact, then we become like beasts. We have no more purpose in life than, you know, deer, elk, mice, ants, whatever it might be. In fact, modern day, you know, philosophy and evolution teaches that we are simply one of the animals. You know, we're just like all the other animals. Well, I don't think we are like all the other animals. I think we have some significant differences. So the you know, the emotions that people feel when they're engaged and in love. We had a couple phone calls this last week from people who just got engaged, and you know how giddy head over heels they are and excited. This is the girl for me. I've been waiting for years, and got a call from a young lady who wants me to do her wedding later this year. That's just so giddy and excited about finally having found the man and being in love, and it's just like they're walking on clouds. I mean, how does evolution explain that? I mean, I've seen dogs in love. They don't do that. Deer, you know, I've tried to shoot deer that were in love, chasing female deer, and they don't do that either. They don't say, this is the doe for me. They say, this is doe number 260, and I can't wait for 261. So, I don't want to be too, you know, graphic in church, but you know what I mean. What Paul is, or what Jude is saying here is very important to understand, that what people know naturally, what they experience with their hands, this empirical knowledge that we can see, touch, feel, smell, observe, write down, calculate about, only leads to people becoming like animals. And it says, in these things they corrupt themselves. Without God's guidance in our life, all of this empirical knowledge amounts to nothing more than a curse. Let's go over to Romans chapter 1 and verse 21. You know, with God guiding our life and telling us why and how, boy, I tell you, the entire world is open. We know why we get married and form families. We know why we have these emotions. We know why we were born. We know why we die. We know why we have a wonderful future to look forward to. We have laws that guide us that we can live by. So what Jude is saying is that these false teachers are giving you their own physical knowledge, which will lead to you becoming like beasts, and in fact, turning away from being the great blessed truth of being, you know, people begotten by God, temples of His Holy Spirit, to becoming nothing more than just animals. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 21, we have this same philosophy here that Paul talked about. And this is summarized. This is what Jude is summarizing. It says, because although they knew God, so people had a fundamental concept of God, They chose not to glorify him. They chose instead, of course, to glorify themselves. They said, we don't need God. We're going to do this all on our own. As God, nor were thankful. They were not thankful that they had a knowledge of God or God was there available to them, but became futile in their thoughts. So their thoughts became nothing but about their own physical life or what they could observe or perhaps what they could do to, you know, gain more in this life. And their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, became, well, they're wise about all these things, and certainly the Greeks had a competition as to who could appear to be the most wise. And Paul, of course, came into that contact with that on Mars Hill in Acts 17 and says, oh, let's see what this guy has to say. He might have some new thing to argue about. So they professed to be wise, and they became fools. When people profess to be wise in their own eyes or in their own knowledge and they reject God, they are all automatically fools. Remember, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. So they began to worship their fellow men. The Roman Empire worshiped Caesar. Coming down to us in recent times, and history is a long litany of individual tyrants who wanted to be worshiped. Stalin, and of course, in ancient Rome, they had statues, but in our time, they've had big posters and banners with pictures of Stalin, Mao Zedong. In Cuba, it's been Fidel Castro. If I remember right, my memory is not always good, but when the Americans occupied Baghdad in 2003, I believe there were over 5,000 billboards and big flags on buildings with a picture of Saddam Hussein. I don't know why anybody thinks they're that good looking that they should have the entire city. But I think his law was that from any particular place in the city, you had to see at least three big billboards or banners of his face. Now, this is an observation, nothing more. So that's sort of starting up in this country, if you've seen what's been happening in recent times. There's this picture of our president-elect that looks strikingly like the pictures of Stalin and Mussolini. I mean, just the way it is, the profile is almost identical. And I think it should give us pause. It should give us pause to say, you know, wow, are we as a nation rejecting God so much that we are now changing to where we could be susceptible to some sort of tyrannical government? Maybe. It could be that our national sins are such that God's not going to remove it from us and let us go through it. So if that's the case, then maybe we have only a few years left. I don't know. You know, we don't set dates. I know there are people out there setting dates. There are those who, the last two dates I heard were 2011 and 2015, 2017. Anybody ever hear that? Know what I'm talking about? No? Yeah, there's a popular church here in the West, popular in the sense of the internet, not large numbers of attendees, but some. And what they've got figured out is that there's 1,335 days, and they believe that Christ is going to come on the day of Pentecost and rapture by the heaven. And then 1,335 days later on the Day of Trumpets, they're all going to come back down to the Mount of Olives. So it's kind of a modified rapture theory. Now, it's fundamentally wrong. You know why it's fundamentally wrong? Because the 1,335 days is probably after Christ returns. In other words, it doesn't all end at 1,335, 12, 60, 12, 90, and 1,335. This was a sermon I was going to give at the feast, but I didn't because they keep giving me these last great day sermons. So remember, at the end of the 1,335 days, you are blessed, right? Remember, what does Christ say when you're blessed? He said, come you blessed of my Father, receive the kingdom, or inherit the kingdom prepared for you. Well, the day he returns is not the day the kingdom is prepared. We have to have Israel migrate through. They have to rebuild the temple of Ezekiel. We've got 45 days there after Christ returns before the kingdom is proclaimed. So the entire concept of the 1,335 being from when the church is raptured to when Christ returns is fundamentally flawed. But when you start with a fundamental flaw and then start adding to it and making more fundamental flawed conclusions, they concluded that there are only 2 years in the next 30 or so when there are 1,335, why am I talking about this? I just want to let you know. I want you to be forearmed and warned ahead of time, okay? That it's not true, it's just some new thing. So the idea is that between Pentecost of 1 year and then 3.5 years later or 3 years later, 1,335 days is about 3 years and whatever, 4 months, that there are only 2 years where there are 1,335 days between Pentecost and then trumpets 3 years and 4 months later, and that's 2011 and 2000, I believe, and 17. So they're now looking at those 2 years as being the only possible fulfillments when, you know, Christ has to return during that time. So I just told you I disagree with it and why, but Remember, you heard it here first, so when you hear about it again, you'll know that they were wrong and that the Bible was right, and that those who are trying to once again set dates, I think, are probably going to prove that Christ was right when he said, no man knows the day or the hour, and that we don't know until it actually starts to occur. We know the times, we know the fig tree, we know that what's happening in our country and what's happening to our nation, what's happening to our world, but no man knows the day or the hour. And certainly when we make wrong assumptions about prophetic times, like the times of the Gentiles ending in 1844 with William Miller, ended up being called the Great Disappointment. So let's look over here in Romans, just continue here, Romans chapter 1. It says, God also gave them up, verse 24, to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. So after you've rejected God, you've looked at empirical knowledge only, and you've concluded that life has no meaning, we are all like animals, then God says they exchange the truth for a lie, the lie that God is true and that the creation is created, not to be worshipped. They worship the creation rather than the creator. And of course, then once they do that, once you think there's nothing more than what is here, and once you are like Shirley MacLaine, who got up on stage many times and proclaimed, we are God, I am God, you know, we are all God, there's nothing more than just us. I think there are even those who, during this past holiday season, we're trying to put placards up in our Capitol and various things that said, you know, there is nothing but man, there are no gods. I think they'll be sadly disappointed someday. But what happens then is that God gives them up to vile passions. God no longer gives them a conscience. He allows their conscience to be seared. For even women exchange the natural use for what is against nature. So we have then the final result of this teaching, very plain, is that the degeneration of human activity occurs. Now, I think the last thing we have time to cover today is the concept of Cain. The next subject mentions, it says in verse 11 in Jude, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain. Now, what was the way of Cain? Obviously, Cain killed his brother, so he was a murderer, so these people are all murderers, right? Well, maybe. That's the final end of it. But let's go back to Genesis chapter 4 and look at what the way of Cain is. Now, there was a way of Cain, not just an act or a murder committed by Cain. In Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. This is after they had been kicked out of the garden, so Cain is the firstborn. He is the firstborn of mankind. Eve may have thought he was the Redeemer who would get them back into good graces with God. After all, there was somewhat of a prophecy about that that God uttered. So we have Cain here who was, at least we know he was a spoiled brat. And we don't know much about him, but he would have been adored by his mother. He would have been raised up to think that he was certainly someone special. He was, you know, the prince or the firstborn of mankind. And Eve says, I have acquired a man from the Lord. So Eve thought, this guy's pretty hot stuff. And he may have been raised to think that. He was probably the first boy in the neighborhood to get a new bicycle, all kinds of things. Of course, he was the first boy in the neighborhood even to do anything. So she bore him again. She bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So Abel kept sheep, and Cain was a gardener or a farmer. In the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought forth an offering of the fruit of the ground of the Lord. And Abel brought forth of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. Now, who knows what this really meant? There are some commentators who believe, and I think that for a while many in the church and the ministry believed, that this was a forerunner to Passover, and God had told them both to take a Passover lamb. And Cain, of course, said, well, I don't like sheep. My brother's a raiser of sheep. I'm going to instead give a grain offering. And because of rebellion like that, God said no, if it was to be a type of a Passover lamb. We really don't know. In the movie, The Bible in the Beginning, which has a lot of fiction in it, in this little scene, as I recall, Cain is putting out this offering, and he has a kind of a big basket there of wheat, and he's putting it all out, and he takes it over and places it before God, but then he kind of looks around and thinks, you know, this is too much, so he takes a bunch of it back and puts it back over in his sack. And then anybody else see the movie in the beginning where he does that? See, Joe knows that. It's amazing how we Chicago Italian heritage guys have so much in common. So anyway, the wind starts to blow, and, you know, all kinds of bad things happen to Cain, and God doesn't accept his offering. So we don't know how it happened. We have no details here. All we know is it says God did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. In other words, he is angry that his brother's offering is accepted and his is not. He is jealous. He has envy, and that envy turns into hatred. So the way of Cain is utter selfishness. It's wanting to be the top dog, wanting to be the one who is the star. The way of Cain is simply one of self-exaltation or aggrandizement and wanting to put somebody else down. So the way of Cain isn't just his act. His act was a result of the way he was. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen?" And of course he said, well, this is interesting because God here, after his offering is not accepted, God says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? It's sort of like he's giving him a chance here to repent. Look, if you do things the way I told you to do it, you know, go buy a lamb from your brother or whatever instructions were given, then you'll be accepted. I will accept your offering if you will do it the correct way. The same is true to us. We are living sacrifices today, and God will accept our offering, our sacrifices, if we do it according to his will. You know, our life is an offering to him. He says, if you do not do well, then sin lies at the door, or you have the burden of sin on you. If you don't do it right, you're going to be guilty of sin, which you already have been, he says. So, and its desire is for you. Sin is almost like it has a mind of its own. It desires you. It wants you to sin, to be under its grip. But it says you should rule over it. So God is telling Cain, you should have enough character to say no. And you should rule over this passion of sin. But Cain did not do what God said. Cain simply said, I'm going to kill my brother. I'm going to get rid of the guy who did things right. So Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And of course, the Lord confronted him, and then Cain lied about it. And of course, Cain was then sent out as to run as a vagabond on the earth. The death penalty was not instituted until after Noah, you know, put the boat back on Mount Ararat. And God told Noah that, you know, you must have him that sheds man's blood must have man shed his own blood. It wasn't talking about cutting his finger. It was talking about the death penalty for those who commit murder. And because there was no death penalty before the flood, then the earth became completely filled with violence and completely filled with evil. So it's an interesting just sidelight. But Cain's idea here, Cain's way, was that he wanted to be the guy in charge. He was kind of a spoiled brat. And he refused to do things God's way and did it his own. And, of course, eventually that got him to where he was very envious and had hatred towards his brother and rose up and killed him. That's probably a decent place to stop. Next time we will look at the example of Balaam. In the meantime, I want to just mention that I'm going to be gone. Next week I'm going to be gone over to